Page 6 of your church Bible. Adam lay with his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord, I've brought forth a man." Later, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. But Abel brought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it." Now Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out into the field." And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is more than I can bear. Today you are driving me from the land, and I will be hidden from your presence. I will be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." But the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone kills Cain, he will suffer vengeance seven times over." Then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him would kill him. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain lay with his wife, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch. Cain was then building a city, and he named it after his son Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad was the father of Mahujael, and Mahujael was the father of Methushael, and Methushael was the father of Lamech. Lamech married two women, one named Ada and the other Zillah. Ada gave birth to Jabal. He was the father of those who live in tents and raise livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all who play the harp and flute. Zillah also had a son, Tubal-Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. Tubal-Cain's sister was Naamah. Lamech said to his wives, "Ada and Zillah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times." Adam lay with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son, and named him Seth, saying, "God has granted me another child in place of Abel, since Cain killed him." Seth also had a son, and he named him Enosh. At that time, men began to call on the name of the Lord. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, God shuts the door of the garden at the end of Genesis chapter 3, and that's where we left off last week. There's no way back to Eden. That's the point of the flashing sword that the angels carry outside the garden. So in Genesis 4, we're in the world outside the garden. And it turns out to be a world full of human wickedness. I don't know if you noticed, we heard the first lie and saw the first murder in this chapter. The effects of Adam and Eve's rebellion are more obvious and more serious. Cain is more hardened than his father. Lamech, a disgusting character. But God is still keeping his promises. God still speaks. There's death and there's violence, but life goes on. There's an avalanche of sin rapidly gathering pace through the chapter. But faith lives on outside the garden. So I want to suggest for this morning that Genesis 4 is a story of human wickedness, but it's also the story of God's loving kindness. Human wickedness grows and spreads, and God's loving kindness goes on working. The two strands, if you like, are woven together in the chapter. It's a chapter which explains the ambiguity of the human condition and accounts for so many of the contradictions of our own experience. Because human wickedness and God's loving kindness are woven together in our lives. Look at verse 25 with me, if you would. If you want a text to summarize the message of the chapter, here it is. Eve speaking. She says, God has granted me another child in place of Abel since Cain killed him. Do you see God's loving kindness and human wickedness side by side in the same verse? There's a new baby in the family. It's always a great day, isn't it? God has given them a new son, a new hope for the future. But his mother can't help remember that the boy's eldest brother is a killer, the first murderer. It's a striking chapter, weaving these threads of God's loving kindness and human wickedness together as we go through, and we'll see. Let me set it in context just for a moment. Genesis breaks down into 10 overall sections, which all start in the same way. If you turn back over the page to chapter 2 and verse 4, it says that this is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created. That's the heading for the section. That little phrase, this is the account of, this is the family history of, comes 10 times in Genesis. And if you turn over the page back to chapter 4 now and look at chapter 5 verse 1, there's the next section beginning. This is the written account of Adam's line. Now think about that for a moment. This account outside the garden belongs in the same section as the description, introduction to the garden. We need to let the structure be our teacher. What we're being told to do is to compare life inside the garden with life outside the garden. That's why life inside and outside comes within the same overall section. I'll show you what happens if you do that. I mean, inside the garden, for instance, a talking snake persuaded Eve to disregard God's word. Outside, who needs a snake? Even worse, God himself cannot be persuaded to stop Cain from sinning. So outside the garden, we'll see that sin is now easier than it was inside. Or again, outside the garden, the sins are getting bigger. Inside, Adam's sin was eating forbidden fruit. Outside, Cain is a murderer. There's an old joke about what happened in the garden when God discovered what they'd done. Adam blamed Eve, and Eve blamed the serpent, and the serpent hadn't got a leg to stand on. But when God sentenced them inside the garden, they took their sentences in silence. Outside the garden, Cain protests that God is too hard on him. He's getting a raw deal in spite of what he's done. So sinners are now getting cockier outside the garden. Inside the garden, we saw the devil in action, dressed up as a snake. Outside the garden, we're in the world and struggling with the flesh. So you see, the context teaches us to compare life inside and life outside the garden. That's the message of the overall section. Now, the chapter itself has its own structure. It's a seven-generation genealogy running from Adam down through to Lamech. And if you're interested in family trees, there's a murder story slotted in along the way and a couple of short comments, and we'll come to those. But it's the genealogy that sets up the basic structure for the chapter as a whole. If it seems an unfamiliar technique, then go on one of the city walks around here or any of the London walks. They use exactly this technique. Philip and Helen Jensen have been doing London while they've been here over the last few months. Well, they get a few dates, names, facts, as many as they reckon the average group of tourists can cope with, and then a break for a juicy story of some kind or another about what Pepys did or Cromwell or one of the king's mistresses, or what happened during the Blitz. And then on with the dates, names, facts again. It's the rhythm of how the thing works. Well, again, if we ask the structure to be our teacher, what are we to learn from this genealogical framework? I think we're to learn that these are real people. real events which still influence our lives. And the stories are treated by the New Testament as case studies. The New Testament takes Abel as the model of faith, the first martyr. And Jude expects us to learn from Cain's disastrous example. Well, let's have a look at the details of the chapter, and we'll try and take the whole thing. There are three main sections with three pregnancies as markers. Those who are expecting may find this helpful. Look at verse 1 with me. Adam lay with his wife Eve, and she gave birth to Cain. And now verse 17, you can see it on the English translation. Cain lay with his wife Eve, and she gave birth to a son. And then look at verse 25. Adam lay with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son. See, the same phrase is repeated those three times. The pregnancies mark the structure of the chapter. You've got verses 1 to 16, 17 to 24, and then 25 and 26. And you'll see why as we go along. Let's start then with the murder of Abel in verses 1 to 16. And the movement through these verses is into God's presence with a certain amount of fear and trembling, and then out again. Look at verse 3. Cain and Abel enter God's presence. It says that he brought an offering to the Lord. But now look at verse 16. By the time we get to the end of the section, Cain, where did he go? Out from the Lord's presence. So that's the overall movement. We're going into God's presence and then out again. On either side of the murder, which comes at the center, there's a conversation between God and Cain. God has two questions for Cain before the murder, and then two more questions after the murder. And the structure of these verses puts the murder right at the center. That's what we're about in this first section. Look at verse 1 with me, and we'll work our way towards it. Eve on the birth of her son. I don't know what you would have said if you're a mother and you've had a baby recently. Listen to what Eve says. With the help of the Lord, she says, I have brought forth a man. Most mothers are excited to have sons. There's some pressure in some families to produce sons. But listen to Eve's comment again in your mind. Is she celebrating God's loving kindness to her? Or is she expressing her own human wickedness in making that comment? Do you see, it depends where the emphasis lies. On the help of the Lord or on her own achievement. Can't tell by listening to it who she's talking about. It's an ambiguous comment. God's loving kindness and human wickedness are woven together right at the start. Well, come on to verses 3 and 4. The two brothers bring offerings to the Lord. Farmer Cain brings fruits of the soil. Abel brings fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. He was a shepherd. I don't know how you think Kenneth Branagh would handle verses 3 and 4. Just imagine it for a moment, getting the Branagh treatment. Imagine the two brothers approaching God, some kind of altar, we don't know what, bringing their offerings to the Lord. What do we know of their fears and their feelings as they approach God? First time we've seen this kind of thing happening. And what do we know about what they know at this point? Well, if we allow Genesis to be our teacher, there are some things we know because Genesis tells us, but there's a great deal we don't know because Genesis doesn't say. So, for instance, we don't know if they understand how to approach God at this particular point. Well, they may realize God likes sacrifices from the death of the animals at the end of chapter 3, but we don't know that. And the way it reads, it's as if they bring their offerings before God, each from his own area of work, and then wait to see God's reaction. Well, we're told in verse 4 how God reacted. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. Now, we don't know how they found out that God was giving the thumbs up to one brother, but not to the other. And we don't know what was wrong with Cain's offering. We're not told, actually, if you read the text, that anything was wrong with Cain's offering. See, the issue for Genesis is not Cain's offering, but Cain's reaction. Verse 5, there it comes. Cain, we're told, was very angry. His face was downcast. And it's the strongest word the Bible can produce for Cain's anger. Everywhere else it appears, it's the kind of anger that produces murder. I don't know what you make of all this. I don't know what you think of Cain. It's pretty obvious that he's the villain of the piece. But I guess most of us have a kind of sneaking sympathy for him, don't we? It's easy to feel sorry for him. We can understand his anger. God's reaction seems so arbitrary. It seems unfair. How can we make any sense of it? What did he do wrong? We're not told. And yet we're told clearly that God rejected him and his offering and favored his brother. Well, what on earth is going on in the story that's the way that it's put? Well, someone suggests that God prefers shepherds to gardeners. One commentary, American commentary, suggests God prefers cowboys. It seems to me that's a silly suggestion, quite frankly. Adam, inside the garden, was the gardener. There's no evidence that God prefers those who look after animals to those who grow crops. Or maybe it's the offerings. Perhaps God prefers animal sacrifices to cereal offerings. But that ignores the fact that later on, when God's law is written down, he requires both animal sacrifices and cereal offerings. Some say we haven't got a clue. God's choices are inscrutable. He chooses because he chooses. We've no idea why he reacts like this, and it's a test for Cain. Well, that's true, isn't it? God is sovereign. But is there much evidence that this passage is designed to teach that lesson, that God does what he wants, whether we like it or not? Well, the New Testament, Hebrews, tells us Abel was a man of faith. And on that basis, some say that God knew the motives of the two men as they came to him with their offerings. And he chooses between them on the basis of Abel's faith and Cain's unbelief. I think we're getting warmer at that point. Some say that Abel gave the pick of the flock, and Cain came with, well, whatever he could lay his hands on. In other words, that one offering was better quality, more costly than the other. Well, there may be something in that. Look at verse 4. We're told Abel brought the fat portions from some of the firstborn. Here's one of the big differences between our culture and the Bible. Fat is bad news in our culture, isn't it? In any circumstances, in your arteries, on a plate, round the waistline, fat is not good for us. But for Old Testament readers, and in Old Testament sacrifices, fat portions from some of the firstborn is just the business. But instead of worrying about what's wrong with Cain's offering, because I don't think Genesis is worried about that, I want to show you the way these verses weave together those two strands we started with, God's loving kindness and human wickedness. Because the details make sense with those two strands in our minds. Look at verse 6. God says to Cain, "Why are you angry?" He's not blaming him for bringing the wrong offering, or for lack of faith. He didn't say, "Why did you bring this to me?" or "Why aren't you believing in me?" The issue for Cain is whether or not he's willing to learn and change when God tells him he's wrong, or whether he'll let his anger take over. Well, that's still a big issue for us, isn't it? See, notice how graciously God gives Cain every opportunity to turn back. Verse 6, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted?" See, unlike the snake's questions inside the garden, God's questions outside are designed to change Cain's heart. See, sin is crouching like a wild animal on Cain's doorstep, ready to devour him if he steps in that direction. At this point, Cain is still in a position to make a choice between doing what is right and letting his anger take over. He's in danger of making the wrong decision, and God does everything he can to prevent him. gently but firmly, he confronts him. I guess God may be doing the same for someone here this morning, showing us that it's not too late, still not too late, to do what is right, to save a marriage, to sort out a relationship with a father, brother, sister. He's a God full of loving kindness. Look again at verse 7. See how Cain answers when God questions him. Silence. He has nothing to say. Even when God himself comes and pleads with him not to do what he has in mind, Cain has nothing to say. It's not hard, is it, to see ourselves in him, stubbornly resisting God's warnings when we're determined to do what we know is not right. And then see how Genesis shows us the appalling wickedness of the murder itself. The description is relatively stark and brief, but the word brother is repeated. Look in verse 8. Cain said to his brother Abel. Cain attacked his brother Abel. It was premeditated and unprovoked. He took him out into the field, out of earshot. And this comes right at the center of the account, with no comment, just description. And then God has another question for Cain, again, like the one for Adam, inside the garden. And already God knows the answer before asking. And the personal question for Adam, where are you, Adam, is a social question for Cain. Where is your brother? But instead of admitting responsibility for his brother, Cain lies to his creator. Well, I don't know, he says. And he follows it up with a joke. Of all the moments in which to crack a joke, this seems to me to be the least appropriate. Literally, he says, am I the shepherd's shepherd? And notice the intensity of the language in verse 10. The Lord said, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Abel's blood is screaming as it soaks into the ground. It's the scream of a woman being raped. It's the same word. Extraordinarily intense moment on God's lips. God curses Cain for his crime. Verse 11, look at the violence of the language here. Now you're under a curse, driven from the ground which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. See the picture? Cain has, if you like, poured out his brother's blood for the land to drink. Verse 12, when you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You'll be a restless wanderer on the earth. The land is on Abel's side and against Cain, and God is sending Cain away from the land into exile, just as he did for his own people later. And look at Cain's reaction. Verse 13, my punishment is more than I can bear. Today you're driving me from the land and I'll be hidden from your presence. I'll be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me. He's horrified. He's terrified. He's afraid that other people are going to do to him what he's just done to his brother. But we all know what that feels like, don't we? Outside the garden, we often find ourselves hoping that no one's going to do to us what we've just done to someone else. You see, I don't like it when you do that to me. And she says, or he says, well, now you know what it feels like. Try a taste of your own medicine. So we all experience this anxiety that is new for Cain. But human wickedness, which is obvious here, is not the end of the story. Verses 15 and 16 show us that God's loving kindness is still with Cain, even outside the garden. God is protecting him and will do so. Anybody who kills Cain will face sevenfold or complete retaliation from God. Verse 15, the Lord put a mark on Cain. And all the freaks and nutcases and weirdos, as you know, as well as endless novelists and artists, have had a great time with the mark of Cain. I don't know what your own pet theory is as to what the mark might be. I'll suggest an explanation at the moment. Three of the sillier ideas are a tattoo, special haircut, I mean, perhaps a Mohican haircut to mark out Cain, or maybe a dog, one commentary suggested. Genesis doesn't explain the mark itself. If you look, verse 16, what matters to Genesis is this. Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Eden. See what we're being instructed to do? To compare life inside the garden and life outside the garden. Eden was literally land of delight. Nod is literally land of wandering. Nod is east of Eden, not a good direction to be going in the Bible. Cain is moving further from the garden. There's no way back. Inside the garden, Adam's job was to be the gardener and care for the land and the soil. Outside, Cain is being driven off the land. Inside the garden, the soil had what soaking into it? Water. It was richly watered, we're told. It was a great place to be. Outside, it's got blood soaking into it, screaming out for it. Inside the garden, the Lord was present, that glorious picture of God walking in the cool of the evening, present in the garden for Adam and Eve to enjoy. Outside, oh, God is hidden. Inside the garden, it was a glorious home, custom made, designed by the Creator for Adam and Eve. Outside, Cain is never fully at home. Wasn't this a stunning picture of our world? Restless, wandering, full of human wickedness. A world with blood being poured into its mouth, down its throat, soaking the soil, screaming for God to hear. And a world where God somehow seems elusive, distant. But it's not a hopeless world. Life goes on, even for Cain and his family. God protects Cain, gives generously to him. And the next section, I suggest, shows us what the mark of Cain means. I'll take this in the last section very much more briefly. I'm moving now to the mark of Cain. I want to call the verses 17 to 24 the mark of Cain. The murder of Abel, the mark of Cain. Remember that it's Adam's family tree that gives the chapter its overall structure. Where verse 17, if you look at it, could follow on from verse 2 without a break. The murder story is slotted into the structure. But we're now going seven generations very quickly down from Adam through Cain. There are a couple of extra comments about Enoch and Lamech because next week we're going to meet two other men with the same name who come down through Adam's other son. We need to know the difference between them. It's as simple as that, I think. But once again, the two strands of God's loving kindness and human wickedness are woven together outside the garden. Look at God's loving kindness towards Cain. Verse 17 and 18, he builds a city, fathers a family. They take up farming in verse 20, make music in 21, work with metal in 22. The point, I think, is this. Civilization is developing outside the garden. There's culture and art, technology, even in the land of wandering. And here's the meaning of the mark on Cain, I think. See, Cain was afraid that someone would murder him, and God stops that happening. God stops vengeance and retaliation getting out of hand by allowing Cain and his family to develop into an ordered society with a government and a developing culture. See, God in his loving kindness cares for people who are restless and homesick for him and out of touch with him. And I wonder if you need to hear that this morning. Respond to God's loving kindness to you in so many ways in your life so far. But again, God's loving kindness is not the whole story. Life outside the garden is full of ambiguity. The city is a sign of his generosity, but it's also a symbol of man-made security. See, Adam hid in bushes, but Cain built stone walls to hide behind. Adam looked to God for his future and for his security, but Cain names the city after his son. Looks as if he wants to make a name for himself and guarantee his future from his city and his son. And although, yes, God in his kindness gives the city industry and music and technology and a legal system, at the same time, the same city is full of human wickedness. Look at verse 23, 24. Polygamy, violence, and brutality are there. It's worth spending just a minute on Lamech. He boasts, I think, that he's a legally justified killer. That's the force of the phrase in verse 23. Look at it with me. He says, I've killed a man for wounding me, for injuring me. In other words, he's killed the man in self-defense, I think. In contrast with Cain's crime, which was unprovoked and premeditated murder. Now look at verse 24. If Cain is avenged 7 times, then Lamech 77 times. He's saying if God protects a murderer like Cain, how much more will he protect me? Killing a man in self-defense is legally justified homicide. It's not murder. Can you hear nauseating self-righteousness in his tone? He's not so different from us. If that's not the right way to understand it, the right way to understand it is that he's simply boasting of how violent and instant his reactions are. If someone lays a finger on me, I'll kill him, is the other way of reading those verses. Well, do you see how life goes on outside the garden? Cities, families, industry, the arts, creativity, technology. But at the same time, every human activity, all the components of life in the city, including marriage and the family, are now corrupted by sin. God's loving kindness and human wickedness coexist outside the garden. And just as we're about to get thoroughly depressed, and it looks as though wickedness is gaining the upper hand, the chapter ends with just a glimmer of light in the darkness. And we'll end here too. And these last two verses I want to call a new beginning, maybe. A new beginning, maybe. The last paragraph of a long section in Genesis usually looks both ways at once, summarizing the section, looking forward to the next one. That's what this one is doing. God's chosen line is the golden thread that runs through the book. But again, it's standard practice in Genesis to deal with the other sons first and get them out of the way before coming on to the chosen line. So we deal with Ishmael before Isaac, we deal with Esau before Jacob. Again, if we ask the structure of the chapter to be our teacher, we can see what the chapter as a whole is doing now. We're getting the story of Cain and his family out of the way before picking up the golden thread of God's chosen line through Adam's son Seth, because this line, this family, will dominate the rest of the story. And these last two verses give us a glimmer of hope, one in each verse. Verse 25. Seth means something like substitute. God promised back in the garden one of Eve's seed would crush the head of the serpent. And now Eve says thank you to God for giving her another seed. She remembers the murdered son and his murderer. But now with God's help, well, a new start maybe. It's just a glimmer of hope. A glimmer which encourages us to read on in the story. And it's a glimmer which leads ultimately to Jesus, who Luke tells us was born as one of Seth's descendants. Born to fulfill the ancient promises. Born to crush the head of the serpent in his death on the cross for us, as we remember in a moment or two. And now the final glimmer, verse 26. At that time, men began to call on the name of the Lord, either praying or preaching. Preaching is a possible translation. From the footnote, you'll see that. Whichever way we read it, the verse teaches this, and it's a summary of the chapter, if you like. In spite of the ravages of sin spreading down through the generations, which we're now seeing, producing violence and vengeance and murder, in spite of the alienation and anxiety and wandering, in spite of all the ambiguity of life outside the garden, the life of faith goes on, and God can still be known. So Genesis 4 is teaching us that in spite of our appalling wickedness, God, in his loving kindness, goes on speaking to us. God, in his loving kindness, invites us to speak to him. He invites us to put our trust in him, to live outside the garden, listening to his word, trusting in his promises. As the story develops, comes to its climax, we'll see that God so loved the world outside the garden that he gave us his son. Well, we're going to pray together now and call on the name of the Lord. Ermine Desmond is going to come up and lead us. While she's coming to the front, may I suggest we take a moment or two in silence.